Up next, an interview with retired astronaut Steve Swanson.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
If the truth were known, we really delayed this launch so we could get the burritos on time.
I figured that.
The flight director says get back in.
We lost the flight plan out the window.
On all three networks, you replaced all the kitty cartoons.
Houston, we've had a problem.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility
Base
here.
The Eagle has landed.
I was rolling on the moon one day.
Counter,
go and throttle up.
Throttle up. The Earth from here is a grand oasis of the big vastness of space.
You're listening to The Space Program, NASA's past, present, and future.
An interview with retired astronaut Steve Swanson. This is Rich Kirshner reporting. Dr. Swanson graduated from Steamboat Springs High School in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, received a Bachelor of Science in Engineering Physics from the University of Colorado, and a Master of Applied Science in Computer Systems from Florida Atlantic University, and a Doctorate in Computer Science from Texas A&M University. Among his special honors, he was a recipient of the NASA Exceptional Achievement Medal, the NASA's Johnson Space Center Certificate of Accommodation, Flight Simulation Engineering Award, and Phi Kappa Phi Honor Society. Prior to going to NASA, Swanson worked for GTE in Phoenix, Arizona, as a software engineer developing real-time software of telephone system multiplexer demultiplexers. Swanson joined NASA as a systems engineer and a flight engineer in the Aircraft Operations Division of NASA's Johnson Space Center, working on the shuttle training aircraft. The STA is a complex airborne shuttle simulator which models the flight characteristics of the space shuttle from 35,000 feet to main gear touchdown. During his time with the STA, Swanson worked to improve the STA's navigation and control systems and incorporate a real-time wind determination algorithm. In May of 1998, Swanson was selected as mission specialist by NASA and started training in August of 1998. After completing astronaut candidate training, which included intensive instruction in shuttle and International Space Station systems, he was assigned to the Astronaut Office Space Station Operations Branch. He has also worked in the Astronaut Office Robotics Branch and as a CAPCOM, which is a spacecraft communicator, for International Space Station and shuttle missions. Swanson completed advanced training in spacewalk, shuttle and space station, robotic arm operations, and shuttle rendezvous procedures. Dr. Swanson's experience in space included STS-117 on board Atlantis in June of 2007, and that was the 118th shuttle mission and the 21st mission to visit the International Space Station, delivering the second starboard truss segment, the third set of United States solar arrays, batteries, and associated equipment. His next flight was on STS-119 on board Shuttle Discovery in March of 2009. And that was the 125th shuttle mission and the 28th mission to visit the International Space Station, delivering the final starboard truss segment, S6. In March of 2014, Swanson launched aboard a Russian Soyuz rocket from Baikonur, Kazakhstan, as members of Expedition 39. The crew docked with the International Space Station on March 27th. During his six-month tour of duty aboard the orbiting laboratory, Swanson performed various Earth remote sensing and biology bone and muscle physiology studies. In May of 2014, Swanson assumed command of the space station with the departure of the Expedition 39 commander. Expedition 40 concluded on September the 10th with a safe landing in central Kazakhstan, marking an end to 169 days in space that covered almost 72 million miles in orbit. During his NASA career, Swanson has completed 4 spacewalks totaling 26 hours, 22 minutes, and accumulated 195 days, 15 hours, 41 minutes in space.
You're listening to The Space Program.
We're speaking with Steve Swanson, former NASA astronaut. Thank you for joining us, and how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
What was the process of you becoming an astronaut?
It's a pretty long process to become an astronaut.
I didn't start trying or even think about it until I was about 25. I just finished a master's. And I, at that time, decided to try to really think about what I wanted to do with my life, as in not just be an engineer, but to also what I want as a career. And that's where the idea of being an astronaut hit. It would be physically challenging, mentally challenging, have adventure, sound like a fun time. So I decided to try for it that time. And so then I started applying to NASA. I started working as an engineer, got more experience in operations and in flight. I ended up working for the Aircraft Operation Division of NASA at Johnson Space Center. So I got to work on airplanes and fly airplanes. It gave me that experience. I went and also got a PhD in computer science. And that combination gave me the opportunity to be at least qualified for the astronaut program, and luckily I got in from there.
You worked with the shuttle training aircraft. How well did it simulate an actual shuttle descent during the approach and landing phase?
It actually did really, really well. So it simulates the shuttle from 35,000 feet to main gear touchdown of the shuttle. And that lasts about a little over 3 minutes, that whole process, that simulation. And it was amazing that it could do. So the way it would work is we would have a software model of the shuttle inside the computers of the shuttle training aircraft. And so as the astronaut would make inputs with the stick on as he's flying it, it would actually make inputs into this model, which would then determine what the shuttle's parameters would be, such as the pitch and roll, et cetera, and the speeds. It would all calculate out what it's supposed to be. And then we had a program that would then make the shuttle training aircraft, which is a modified G2, match the shuttle parameters. And so that's the way it would work. And it was really fun to work on that and work on these algorithms and control laws and everything like this we did. I really enjoyed that. And it did a really good job of giving the astronauts a way to practice this landing, because the first time they do it is going to be the real time, you know, the real shuttle. It's going to be the first time, and there are no go-arounds. It's a glider at that point. And so you have to do it right the first time.
Now, G2, that's a Gulfstream 2?
That's a Gulfstream 2, yes.
Okay. That's my memory serving me well, I guess.
Yeah, that was great.
What were a couple of the most challenging activities during your training?
Oh, training. That's a good one. So for our shuttle flight, it's about a year's worth of training. And we spend, I'd say, almost 40 to 50% of that time is on the launch and landing phase. I was a flight engineer, so I was part of the team between the pilot, the commander, and the flight engineer. We have to do all that training and work all the procedures, off nominal and nominal procedures, and you just spend so much time working all the possibilities, because there are just a tremendous number of possibilities and things that can go wrong, and you have to know how to handle each one of these, and then multiple of each one of these. And so it ends up being a lot of time doing that, and a lot of information you have to have in your head. And then the other biggest thing was spacewalks. And so each one of my shuttle missions, we did spacewalks on them. I did those as part of the teams that did that, I should say. And that, for every spacewalk you're going to do, you do at least 7 in the pool we have, which is called the Neutral Buoyancy Laboratory. So, and then it's a big pool. It's about 100 feet by 200 feet by 40 feet deep. And we do these training runs, so you do at least 7. And then you have other contingencies that we work on, too. So there's, if things can go wrong, we have to train for those spacewalks for things that go wrong. So you spend a lot of time in this pool, and that's a full day of work. You're 6 hours in the water, but then you have a brief beforehand. You have to get yourself ready, go through a medical test. And then afterwards, we go over everything in detail, what went wrong, what went right, how we want to change procedures, all that. So it ends up being a really, really long day and a very tiring day.
I'm sure it would be. I've actually visited the NBO once. It's incredible. You actually wiped out half of my next question. Thank you very much.
Sorry about that.
Not at all. Could you actually describe this? It's basically a massive pool. Do you remember the volume? I remember it's huge. And can you describe what's sunken into it?
And now, I don't remember the volume. That was a number. I just remember the dimensional size of it, 100 feet by 200 feet by 40 feet. Those are numbers I can remember. Sunk into it is we call it a mock-up or a model of the space station, but it's really just on the outside of the space station with the handrails and everything else that's out there that you're going to use to get yourself around. Now, but you see, that is still not even big enough to put the whole space station in. So we would have to break up the space station into parts and do different segments at different times with what's ever in the pool at that way. So it always was very interesting to me that that pool, even though it's huge, is not even close enough or near close enough to have a space station in kind of its complete configuration in the pool.
I remember it was so deep that I could actually see blue. And our tour guide told us, yes, water, at you know, when it becomes deep enough, it does have a slight blue color to it, and it was blue.
Yeah, yeah, it is pretty deep. And that's one thing when you're in, that you still get, and when you go in the suit, we're in the space suit, so we are breathing the air coming in that way. But you, as you go down, you still have to clear your ears, just like you would in any pool or scuba diving. And so that's one of the biggest tasks of going back and forth and training in the pool, is you got to make sure, that's why we had the medical test, to make sure you can clear your ears all the time. And as you imagine, you can't get to your nose because you have a helmet on. So you can't you do the Valsalva usually is, by holding your nose and blowing and squeezing to get the ears to pop. So we have a little device that's on our helmet, basically foam, that we can put our nose into to squeeze it down so we can do that.
I was going to ask you, because a Valsalva is impossible without fingers. That's pretty cool. I didn't know that they had that built into the helmet. Now, do you nudge your nose into it, or do you move a lever on the exterior of your spacesuit?
Yeah, we just nudge your nose into it. And honestly, one of the best purposes of that whole device is also to scratch your nose.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a question that I've been asked before. How do you scratch an itch when you're in a spacesuit for, 8 hours, between pre-breathe and all of that. It's just got to drive you bananas.
You don't think about it. That's the first rule.
That's good. That's good. That's a good training.
You're listening to The Space Program.
We're speaking with retired NASA astronaut Steve Swanson. Your first flight was on Atlantis in June of 2007. Could you share your personal highlights of that mission?
Oh, that was a great flight for me, being a rookie on that flight. I got to be flight engineer, which was a great job as a mission specialist. So you're part of the, the command deck, and we're working all the procedures for launch and entry and orbital maneuvers, all that, which is really a great opportunity. And I also got to fly both robotic arms on that mission, the shuttle robotic arm and the station robotic arm, both for moving a module out and for having another crew member on the arm doing a spacewalk. That was fun to do. And then I got to do two spacewalks also myself on that one. And it was just a great mission for me then. And our goal of that mission was to put a solar array on the space station. We actually put the S3, S4, which is S stands for starboard, truss segment on the space station. And on that, it had a solar array. And also had the alpha rotary joint. So if you notice, the solar rays can rotate 360 degrees around and around as it follows the sun. And that's the joint that we put on along with the solar ray. And that was it was a great, great mission. And it went really well. Of course, I might be biased on that, but I thought it went really well. And it was just a great opportunity for me to have all of those experiences in one flight.
Your second flight was on Discovery in March of 2009. How did that mission differ from your first flight?
Well, the task was actually quite similar. It was also putting on a solar array truss segment. It was called the S6 or Starboard 6. And it had very similar aspects to it. And that's why I got assigned to it as in the lead spacewalker kind of and other lead roles on that mission. And the person who joined me as the pilot of SGS-117 in my first mission was now the commander. So we moved up from the rookie roles to leadership roles from that two missions. We did that together. And the reason I think they did that gave us that opportunity was the fact that we had just done one very similar to that. We weren't really sure about NASA's decision-making capability, putting both of us together as rookies and now we're the leadership on this new one. But it worked out again, so we ended up, two spacewalks and a flight engineer and a robotic arm operations, et cetera. Again, we had a successful mission, so it was similar, but just a different role for me.
Then your third flight was on a Russian Soyuz compared to a shuttle, taking you up to the space station. That had to be rather cramped. I've always wondered, why does it take 2 days to rendezvous and dock with the space station, as Gemini was able to do the same with a target vehicle in the first 100 minutes in the mid-60s? Is that something that you're qualified to inform me about?
Oh, yeah. So it's all about, and that Gemini, remember, they launched right after their rocket, so they were in the same orbital plane and very close to it when they launched. So we, in a Soyuz, actually, when I went in 2014, you were scheduled for a six-hour rendezvous. So that's what they, and it's all about when you, what, the constraining your launch parameters, and if you do that more tightly, then you can rendezvous more closely. So it's scheduled for 6 hours rather than 2 days, but I have to admit that we had a software problem on our Soyuz, and we had to then download or go back to the old program for the 52-hour rendezvous program because of the issues we had.
Oh, my.
Well, yeah, it was not, because we weren't planning for that. So that was actually a little difficult for us, I have to admit, because we didn't think we were going to do that. So we didn't have done, did all the normal planning that people had been doing for years on that. And so it took us by surprise, and it was definitely then a long 2 days of hanging out in that vehicle and waiting to get to station.
I've seen the interior of a Soyuz, and there isn't much to it.
No, there's not much room. I'd say it's about, I'm going to guess it's 7 feet across, maybe 4.5 feet high and 4.5 feet deep or something like that. So you're pretty cramped in there. And to me, the thing that got me the most, honestly, I realized, which I wasn't planning on, was to save fuel on a Soyuz, because there's lots of time you're just going around the Earth and not doing anything but just waiting to catch up to the space station. You will point your solar rays at the sun. You'll spin the vehicle, and then you turn everything off so that it stabilizes with a spin and keeps the solar rays pointed to the sun and not use any fuel at all. And that's the way you do this for 8 hours at a time. And that spinning after a while ended up getting to me slowly and slowly, just got a little bit worse and worse. It was something I wasn't prepared for.
Well, it's actually been an extremely reliable vehicle since, I think, 1967, with the exception of this last launch.
There have been a few other accidents, but they all happened within like the first 10 years of the program of the vehicle. And so then it was right. It was for the last 20 some years, it was really reliable. And then, of course, this last launch was not. And I was sure happy to see the abort stage work really well on that. I was never sure that was going to work because you never know. You know, they haven't had to use it. And so you always wonder how much care they were taking into that. And it worked really, really well. So that was a plus for the system to me, even though it, you know, overall did not work as planned. But the abort system worked really well.
I'm not familiar with the actual abort profile. I know there's multiple modules. Which one goes off first? And then you get the orbital module.
So what happened on the way they worked the abort profile for, say, this last abort they did, and that was the crew capsule plus the other parts of a Soyuz. Actually, is broken into three parts. It has the crew capsule. It has, they call it the HAB module, and then it has an electronics module. And they're all pretty small and all hooked together. And so normally when you get to orbit, you stay with those three all the way to docking and then undocking. And then when you come home, just you do your deorbit burn, and then you separate out the HAB module, crew module, and electronics module so that you only have the crew module come back safely. So think of it that way. So when you abort, those are still all together, and they have a rocket attached to the top of them that will pull them off of the main rocket that is launching you into space. It's abort launch motors, and they will pull, so you'll basically come free of the normal rocket itself, have those motors, which are very high performance, will pull you off at approximately 8 G's off of the rocket and send you up higher, and then you do a ballistic reentry back into at atmosphere, because it pulls you high enough to be out of the atmosphere. You come back in, and before you come back in the atmosphere, then you do separate out into the three parts, and the crew capsule, which has a parachute on it, will do the first reentry. You hit about 8 G's on that. Also on the ballistic reentry is about 8 G's. Once you slow down enough, the parachute comes out and you land normally in Kazakhstan.
Well, I've been on some Carnival rides, but never 8 G's, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's definitely a wild ride, and I actually haven't got to talk to Nick yet about how it went, but I'm looking forward to that conversation.
You're listening to The Space Program.
Well, after 6 months in space, how did you feel and recover when you returned?
Yes, that's a good one. On a normal reentry, it's only 4.5 G's, so it's not as much as the 8 G's, but it's still pretty heavy since you've been floating around and not having any G's for the last 6 months. But I thought what was really interesting to me, I kind of liked it, which you might feel is different or weird. And the reason was I had not laid down or got myself relaxed in a chair for 6 months. I'd floated the whole time. And the idea of being in a, we have a almost like these bucket seats that we are laying on our back, and they are custom fit to our body. They have actually a foam liner in there that they took a mold of our body and they put it there. And so when you get the pressure coming down on you on that, it actually like squeezes you into it. And that actually felt good to me to have that pressure on my body. I thought that was, I was not expecting that at all. And so it was really interesting to have this pressure, and it's like, oh my God, this feels good again. Like I'm laying down again. And that was really not too bad at all. The most dynamic part of that flight is the next part when the parachute comes out, and the parachute comes out in stages. It's staged, it comes out reefed or smaller, and then has multiple stages where it gets bigger to slow you down more and more. And each time it comes out, there is a jolt, of course, as you can imagine, but they also spin the vehicle to stabilize it. So not only are you getting jolts, you're getting spun at the same time, and you're getting knocked around pretty good, again, like a good Disneyland ride. So that was definitely a dynamic phase of flight, especially after you've been in space for 6 months.
I can imagine. I remember speaking with John Phillips, who you probably know, and he said one of the things that he missed on orbit was weather. He liked humidity, wind, things like that, because the atmosphere on board the space station is completely sterile. It's just, it's nothing.
It's the same every day. You don't have to check your phone to see what the weather's going to be, that's for sure. It is the same. Yeah, I flew with John on 119, and yes, I agree completely with what he says. And, you know, I didn't really, I think, realize how much I missed it until I got back on Earth. And we landed in Kazakhstan, and it was a cool, crisp morning, about 45 degrees, nice morning in September. And you could just smell the earth and the wind on your face and the sun on your face. It was like, yeah, I didn't realize how much I missed it, I should say, you know. And you come back and you actually get it again, like, oh my God, this is fantastic. And, you know, just being able to smell the earth was this interesting feeling to me.
That's great. The astronauts that I've spoken with on the space station, when they have a resupply vehicle come on and the vehicle docks and they equalize the pressure, open the hatches, what are the first smells that you smelled?
Oh, man, I don't even remember that.
I was told about fresh apples and oranges and things
like
that.
Yeah, but I couldn't. They had them, once I had them, and they were pretty well, I couldn't smell them right away. So I didn't get that smell. Interesting. Yeah, I didn't have that initial smell when we opened up the hatches. I also, I'll admit, though, I broke my nose when I was younger, and I might not have the best sense of smell. So that's probably, which actually is a good thing on station, I'll admit.
Nice. That's good. See, this is why I interview you folks, because I get that inside information that I never ask anybody how you go to the bathroom in space. It's kind of redundant, and we don't need to hear about that. We're speaking with retired astronaut Steve Swanson. Doctor, how have you kept busy since you left NASA?
I'm now working for Boise State University, and it's kind of fun working with students again. Multiple projects I work with, mostly NASA-related projects. NASA puts out these challenges for students to like build a new spacewalking tool, or now we're working on a heads-up display for a spacesuit, stuff like that, which I think are really great challenges. They get the students motivated. And one thing I really liked about it, I have to admit, is that they have so much more, I guess, enthusiasm for NASA and what it does. After 28 years of working at NASA, I got a little jaded. You can imagine working for the government for that long, going through furloughs possibly, et cetera. And you do become a little jaded what you're doing. You know, it's there's lots of always, you know, red tape, politics, et cetera, no matter what job you have, right? And so sometimes you forget about how cool your job really is and what you're doing and how wonderful it is. And so you get to see these students who get so enthused about it that it kind of gives you that idea again, oh, yeah, that was really fun. That was really cool to do. You know, it's great to be around them.
Well, I've saved the most important question for last. I know you're waiting for this one.
Yeah.
I ask this of all of our guests. What's your favorite food, and what do you want for Christmas?
Oh, my favorite food, and what do I want for Christmas? I think probably my favorite food is Tex-Mex fajitas down in Houston. That's one thing I miss tremendously about Houston is Tex-Mex food. Maybe it's because I can't get it here that I crave it all the time, and that's great. And, boy, for what do I want for Christmas? Since I just had Christmas, I kind of did pretty well with that. But I'm going to go for a new pair of Alpine Touring ski boots.
Well, that's good. I like that.
Yeah, I've got into Alpine Touring a little bit more, and I like it. And I want to get a new pair of boots there, too, because the ones I have are really heavy. And I was just doing it on Saturday. And it got me really, really tired. It was a great workout, but everybody else was cruising faster than I was.
Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your memories. Good luck to the Boise State Broncos in the future. Take care and Godspeed from Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Hey, thank you very much, Rich.
An interview with former astronaut Steve Swanson. This is Rich Kirshner reporting.
From the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
This has been The Space Program, NASA's past, present, and future.